Hello and welcome to the Mixed Media Podcast for Wednesday, October 7th. I'm Chris Wagner, culture critic for the Dallas Morning News. I'm joined, as always, in the studio by one Christopher Wynn.
Christopher
is the deputy editor for FD, the style magazine of the Dallas Morning News. Hello, Christopher.
Hello, this is Christopher. Hello, Chris Wagner.
Hello, Christopher Wynn. And also joining us, as always, is Lauren Smart, the arts and culture editor for the Dallas Observer. Hello, Lauren.
Hello.
Today, Dallas composer Donald Fowler discusses the debut of his long-awaited Jack the Ripper-inspired musical, Creep. Dallas Morning News architecture critic Mark Lamster talks about museums, architecture, and the Nasher Prize. And FD Magazine's Christopher Wynn, who you just heard from.
Christopher.
He's still here. Revisits his story about Dallas architect Russell. Yes, that's him. Dallas architect Russell Buchanan, who was wrongly suspected. I'm sorry, wrongly accused. Accused, right, Christopher?
Suspected. He wasn't charged officially, but he was accused verbally.
Dallas architect Russell Buchanan was wrongly suspected of raping and murdering an SMU sorority girl in 1984 during Texas OU weekend. The story has been dramatized in a new investigative TV show called Suspicion. What explains the ongoing fascination with this case and with murder entertainment in general? We'll hash it out with help from Dallas Morning News crime writer Tristan Hellman. Now, let's get this started. When a musical bills itself as scary, it's natural to be a little dubious, unless what scares you are chorus girls or people who sporadically break into song and dance. I find those things frightening, actually. The odds of a stage musical sending a shiver down your spine are long, but those odds haven't stopped Donald Fowler. Over the course of nearly 15 years, he has pursued an obsession with Jack the Ripper, the infamous serial killer whose bloody knife work terrorized London's Whitechapel neighborhood in the late 19th century. Now Fowler brings the premiere of his musical Creep to the stage at Water Tower Theater in Addison. Donald, thank you for joining us.
Oh my God, thank you for having me.
So when did your obsession with Jack the Ripper commence?
Well, I think it started... I'd been working on some music and I didn't know what it connected to or what it was. And I was watching a...
Oh boy.
A brilliant movie called From Hell with Johnny Depp.
Heather Graham.
Another fine little actress.
The Hughes brothers.
Yeah. And I was watching it and I was like, oh my gosh, that's what it is. So from that moment, it started plummeting forward and I started doing a lot of research and sort of figuring out what my attack was going to be, but I knew that it was going to fit in that era and it was going to work around either literally or not literally and ultimately not literally the facts, what we think we know about Jack the Ripper.
So what got you started writing music in the first place? Because you have told everyone who's interviewed you, you don't know how to read or write music.
That's correct.
So why were you writing music and how?
Why were you doing that? You're not supposed to do that.
What's that about? Yeah.
You know, ever since I was little, whatever your belief system is, I have a God thing. I believe that it was a gift. Mm-hmm. But I can do it. I've done it since I was little. I had put it away to act. And my fingers literally were itchy, and I know what that is. So I bought a really small Casio keyboard and started working, and then it sort of expanded. So
before that, you were acting in musicals.
That is correct.
Can you give us a little summary of your career up to the point that you sat down to write a musical? Just what were you doing? What kind of shows were you in?
Okay. Well, at 30, I was doing a lot of things I probably shouldn't be doing. And
that's a different show, different podcast.
Yeah, it's coming next. And decided to drop everything and do the thing that was important to me. So I drove to L.A. I was going to be an actor. And I ended up studying with Jeff Goldblum and Bob Carnegie out at Playhouse West. And I did that for about 3.5 years and to minimal success, however you measure that. And then through a series of events, realized it was time for me to leave L.A. and came here to sort of regroup. And then doors started opening and opening. And I started working you know, in my career, my professional career, and then as an actor and singer, and really started growing. So I've worked all over the place here in town.
And you were once described by our critic as like breathtakingly handsome or unbelievably handsome. So you were always playing sort of the male leads in those shows, right?
Yes, that's probably true because I'm so beautiful.
You do have very classic leading man looks.
Yes, I am both those things. Sadly, they're sort of gradually peeling away by now.
Not at all. Mm-hmm.
So, Donald, is this a sympathetic portrait of Jack the Ripper? We think of him as this monster. He did all these horrible things. And like you said, there's a lot we don't know about him.
Yeah, look, I think I let that window sort of open up. And it's really not a literal telling of who Jack the Ripper is. Frankly, I don't care about that. And frankly, we don't know. All the murders could potentially be Jack the Ripper. None of the murders could really be Jack the Ripper. I think it's commonly accepted now that the Dear Boss letter was not even written by Jack the Ripper. It was a journalist. So I was more interested in, so what then? What do we have? And I'm really fascinated by secrets and what they do to people. And I think that's what the show's really about, is what will you do to keep them hid? How long will you do that, and what will that do to you?
Well, and a big part of the show, even in one of the opening lines of the songs, for the first song, is part of the game will be finding out who he is. So I want to listen to Dear Boss, which opens the second act.
Right.
And you have to sort of solve the problem of not knowing who Jack the Ripper is. You have everyone in the cast sort of sing that song. So let's listen to that for a second.
I keep hearing the police have caught me, but they won't fix me just yet. I have laughed when they look so clever and talk about being on the right track. That joke about leather apron gave me real fits. I'm down on doors and I shan't quit gripping.
I love how that sort of builds there toward the end, too. You know, Donald, I'm curious. I had a chance to see an early workshop of your musical, and I'm curious what that process was like for you, because you actually got feedback from people once they saw it. And how did the musical then evolve after that?
Well, look, most of the response from that workshop was very positive, and I'm suspicious of that. As an artist, one of my big concerns going into the production end with Water Tower was that I did not want to be the emperor with the new clothes. And I, it's grand, it's beautiful. And you're like, okay, really? So most of it was good. There were some people that were wanting to rewrite the musical, and you sort of learn what you can pick from that, though. What are the common things, and what you need to just sort of leave behind and let them write something of their own. So I think the thing I really gained overall was that there was an enormous amount of support for it, and that I was on the right track. So that was very helpful as far as pushing forward in trying to get a main production. Now, certainly things have changed quite a bit from that. One of them is there was a character named Christian, who's a piano teacher, who literally just was gone after the first act. And that never bothered me. In fact, I thought that made him more suspicious. But everybody wanted...
I remember that bothered me.
Yeah, okay.
I'll tell you now, all this time later.
Thank you. Yeah. And now what we did is working with Kate, who is a director out of Philly, was tough as nails, man, and was great, and really challenged me to come up with a way to get him back in that made sense. I didn't want to just have him walk through the room like a photobomb and say something, you know.
There he is.
And another thing.
Yeah.
And it actually worked out really, really great. Everything that's been added, and there's been a lot, has really advanced the clarity of the piece, and certainly raised the stakes for all the characters. So I'm super excited about the changes that got made. Yeah.
We're going to be talking later in the same episode, actually, about why we as a society are obsessed with stories of murder. Mm. Don, why do you think Jack the Ripper has kept a hold of our imagination for all these years?
Because we don't know the answers. And that leaves room for our imaginations to sort of put in there what it is. And we have great imaginations left to our own devices. And I think there's lots of room there to sort of be creative.
Hmm. I'm curious, Donald. I mean, putting a musical together is a huge, huge task.
Mm-hmm.
And
so
I wondered if you could talk a little bit about the process of what it takes to mount a show. And I want to point out for listeners, a lot of people know you through your fabulous day job as showroom manager at Nest, incredibly chic and cool shop on Henderson. How do you make all of that work, keeping that day job, mounting a musical, writing, composing?
Well, how do you do it, man? How do you do it?
Well, I happen to be Superman.
Can you bottle it? Can I buy it?
No, look, it helps.
Is there a pill I can take?
No. But you could work for the nicest people in the whole wide world. And that sounds like a random compliment. But truly, they have been supportive and facilitating the whole way. So Heather and Scott really have enabled me to do it. In a more corporate environment that were very strict, it probably would be a lot harder.
Hey, boss, can I go do this musical thing on the side?
Yeah.
Is that cool?
Yeah, well, not only that, but they're like, and let's help you raise money. I mean, do you know what I mean? That's the way they're working. So it helps to hold out for the smart people and not settle on the people necessarily that are just simply available. And I have been fortunate to surround myself with people that I really respect and that have really challenged me and known where we need to go in the areas that they work in. So, but at one point I thought I was literally going to pull every hair out because every question, because I wrote the book and the lyrics and the music, comes from me, and I was not prepared for that. I worked from the gut, and it just came out, and then all of a sudden I'm challenged on details, and that's not where it started. It's where it's finished, happily, but I really learned a lot about that. But having people that will really challenge you and trying to stay open to that and a reed in the wind through the whole process is really how you do it, I think.
I joked to you a couple weeks ago that you were getting a master class in writing musicals.
That is so true.
Do you think that you'll write another one?
You know what? I do. I have some ideas. I'm not sure what it is yet. I definitely think I'll be smarter and that it will go faster. I think I did a lot of things right, you know, but it's taken. I think hopefully if this show does well and there's chatter, you know, all around it, that it gives me enough pedigree to move things a little faster when I'm ready to start doing the next thing.
So I think we want to hear one more song
from the
show. And if you'll set it up for us, let's Look Through My Eyes.
Oh, that's the love duet.
Yes.
That's the love duet.
In a show that is not a love story.
No. And when you find out what's really going on during this song, you're like, that is really creepy. Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about who sings it.
Oh, sorry. I'm real good at this
good.
Sort
no,
of thing.
You're good.
So there's a Dr. Jackson Crown who has seemingly happened upon a young girl named Mary during her piano lesson. And he is left in the room with Mary alone. And
this already sounds creepy.
And over some time has expressed interest in her, and then it just sort of plummets forward to where she freaks out. He calms her down, and as he's calming her down, and she's like, you don't understand, and he's like, look through my eyes.
Okay, we'll listen.
Through my eyes, see what I see. Let the fear go, stand there empty. I will fill the space that's left behind with all the love that I can find. There's a girl with auburn hair, just in front of standing there. She's afraid of what's inside, still she knows she cannot.
You can read Lauren Smart's profile on Donald Fowler and Creep in this week's Dallas Observer. We'll also post a link on our show page at guidelive.com/podcasts. Donald, how can obsessed fans and potential serial killers reach you?
Personally or for tickets?
However you want to do it.
No. Watertowertheater.org is for the box office. Or the number there at the box is 972-450-6232. And you want to act quick because happily they're selling out.
Wow.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us, Skull.
Oh, my God. Thank you. You guys are the best.
Dallas Morning News architecture critic Mark Lampster recently traveled to L.A. to see a controversial new museum called The Broad. As he writes, quote, "The locals in Los Angeles have taken to calling it a cheese grater, and its architects alternately describe it as a sponge and piece of coral. But feel free to choose your own metaphor. A crate, spaceship, a Hollywood star pimped for the red carpet. It's hard to resist the impulse to name it, and why not? The new Broad Museum, an antique block-sized box, articulated by more than 2,500 concrete modules, is the kind of building that demands your attention and presses the imagination. Here to help us compare and contrast the Broad with Dallas's own fine art institutions is the one, the only, Mark Lampster."
Da, 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 da.
Welcome, welcome, Mr. Lampster.
It's a pleasure to return to the...
Welcome back, yeah.
This fine forum.
So Nick's looking okay. Porzingis gonna
the zinger.
Gonna do some things this year.
It's a very weak Eastern Conference, and our hopes are up. But the Knicks are the Knicks.
Over under on Derek Fisher's job security. How many months? I'm sorry. We're talking about architecture.
Is this men talking sports?
Yeah.
Is this a nice callback to our last episode?
We're talking Knicks. We're talking Mark Lampster's New York Knicks.
If they have the same record as last year, then he's gone.
Rock and roll. The Broad Museum, Mark Lampster, you recently visited. So this is right in the middle of downtown? Is this smack dab in the middle?
Yes, exactly correct. It's right next to the Walt Disney Concert Hall by Frank Gehry, that sort of giant titanium flower. And this is a sort of inversion of that, whereas the Gehry building is this unspooling titanium structure. This is very much on the outside, a rectangular box. But that rectangular box is very dramatically articulated by these concrete modules of these white concrete modules that allow in light. So they're punctured by the sort of screen, what the architects call a veil.
Or the cheese grater.
The cheese grater, whatever you want to call it. Exactly. Yeah. So the museum houses the collection of Eli and Edith Broad, Los Angeles cultural hegemons, shall we say. And it houses serves as both a warehousing facility and as a gallery for that collection.
So before we get to the Broad specifically, what did you make of downtown L.A. as it currently stands? I was out there a little less than a year ago, and I really enjoyed it, and I was really surprised by how vital that neighborhood has become.
You know, the native New Yorker in me has always had that Woody Allen, reaction to Los Angeles, where, the cultural, highlight of Los Angeles is that you can make a right turn on red. But I'm really growing to love and learning to love Los Angeles, shall we say. And downtown is becoming this, pedestrian-friendly, very vibrant core. And I think the museum plays a part in that. Like Dallas, they're struggling with what to do with their neglected waterway, the L.A. River. We have the Trinity. They have the L.A. River that's also been channelized. And they're also having, conversations about how to turn that into the kind of amenity that could serve the city, and strangely enough, the leader in that movement for the last basically two decades as a Dallasite is a graduate of Highland Park High School. Oh, excuse me, St. Mark's. Congratulations, Los Angeles. You've got one of our best to help you figure out your urban issues.
That came up a lot, too, with Mark Doty, who works with the City of Dallas Preservation Office. He says that LA is doing it right, that Dallas should be following the LA model when it comes to restoration and thoughtful restoration.
I think in a lot of ways, L.A. is a bit ahead of Dallas. And they're very similar cities in that they're both these post-war, defined by the highway, these cities of that are very pocketed. And L.A. is still, it's much harder to deal with than Dallas. You know, the traffic in Los Angeles is apocalyptic. You know, you just cannot go from one place to another in Los Angeles. It's really, really hard. And actually visiting Los Angeles, that's one of the hard things about visiting is that, you know, when you visit a place, you always think, all right, I'm going to have an agenda. I'm going to do these five things today. But in Los Angeles, you can do two things because you can't actually go from more than one place to the next place.
It took the 10, and then it got off Wilshire, and then I had to take a right on.
I know that's the classic SNL Californian sketch. I actually got a when I was planning my visit, I arranged to meet with an architect, and he sent me directions to his office, and it was two pages. Which I thought was sort of like
never, you know, a good sign.
Yeah, that was like an illustration of that sketch. It's not even a sketch; it's just real life, which is kind of sad in a way, but also weird because whoever actually needs directions to anywhere, you just plug it into your phone and it takes you there. So it's an interesting way of thinking about the city.
So let's talk about this museum. We all read you. You are a discriminating critic. I was struck by how positive your tone was for this structure and what it's doing. So tell us what you like about it.
What I liked about it was that I think it's successful urbanistically. I mean, we're sitting here talking about the rejuvenation of downtown Los Angeles, and I think it's very attentive to that rejuvenation, to the way it stands on the street. And on the interior... it's got these very dramatic cinematic moments, which I think are appropriate for a museum in Hollywood, Los Angeles. The galleries are quite beautiful. They generally show the work to good advantage, not entirely. And I think it's a really interesting museum. I've been following these architects for a very long time. They're Diller, Scafidio, and Renfro. They've achieved international fame as the architects of the High Line in New York, which that made them celebrities or starchitects.
I love the High Line.
Yeah.
Made them very in demand, yeah.
Right. But, you know, before that, they'd been practicing for decades, really as academic architects in New York, theorists, more artists or as much artists as architects. And they hadn't built a lot. And they gradually started to build more, and then with the High Line, that sort of has propelled their career to the point where they're doing projects of this kind of scale. So it's been interesting for me to watch their progression and see them mature as actually builders. It's a really beautifully made building, and all of their buildings, historically, they haven't always made physical objects so beautifully because they came out of academia, and this building is quite beautifully made. And you can also see some of the theoretical themes that have defined their work sort of realized at a really grand scale here. You know, a lot of their work, their experimental work, was based on these ideas of technology, on the use of on movement. But especially on this idea of seeing, what is the word I'm looking for? It's great to be blanking up on a radio show.
Mark Webster,
just go with cheese grater.
Professional writer,
cheese grater. No, on the idea of seeing and being seen is crucial to what they do.
Voyeurism.
But also, you know, the tracking, individual tracking, as in the NSA, right?
right.
Surveillance is the word I'm looking for. So a lot of their work is about surveillance and movement and spectacle. And this is really a building about viewing and about it's both demands to be looked at, to be photographed, to be Instagrammed, to be, you know, put on whatever news feed you have. But you know, it's also very much about constructing views for you, but it's also looking at you, right? It's a safe. Basically, the whole system of the building is basically it's a vault for the collection with a gallery plopped on top of it. So it's got this very dual function of surveillance and safety.
And isn't the entrance up into the gallery, it's pretty crazy. The photos that I've seen of it, the escalator, what it enters into looks pretty insane.
It's got this amazing escalator. It's got an 105-foot escalator. It's like a modernist architectural version of Space Mountain. You know, you zip up it. It also has a cylindrical glass elevator that's super cool.
I thought the Perot had a cool escalator, but no.
Yeah, this is... The difference between that building is here, I think that with the Perot is a lot about, you know, is the architect showing off his moves for the sake of showing off his moves. You know, the escalator is brought out and exposed, and a lot of the dramatic spaces, all of the dramatic spaces in the Perot are actually about about circulation spaces, and the galleries are actually kind of dark and cramped.
Is that Thomas Mann?
Tom Mann. Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Los Angeles architect.
Can't believe I know that.
Professor Wagner, I'm impressed.
And whereas here, you know, it's much, they're dramatic spaces. The circulation is very dramatic, but it's really all about getting you to the gallery spaces. There's something beyond its own itself. I've been super inarticulate. Lamster's last appearance on the Mixing Messages
we used
podcast
to
was very disappointing.
We used to enjoy his presence on Mixed Media.
Yes.
And the Broad is also where the Infinity Room is, isn't
correct.
It?
Correct. Yes. The yo-yo.
Did you go into it?
I did. And it's pretty neat. It's pretty neat. Although, I'm not sure where I rank that on, you know, where is, again, you know, we're talking about art and spectacle. I mean, where does that, is it more, maybe that's a little bit like that in the Rain Room, which was also super popular up at MoMA last year. I mean, I think there's like this curve of what is spectacle and what is serious art. And it's sort of interesting in that is it a gimmick or is it a, is there anything there beyond it, right?
Right.
So in the open, we use the word controversial. From whence does said controversy spring? Why is this controversial?
Well, any number of reasons. LA architects working in New York, there are inevitably are critics who find that their formalism is unappealing, don't like the way the galleries lurk. But the main controversy over it is about the patrons, Eli and Edith Broad. The collection is really very driven by art market decisions. And there's some question as to why they needed their own private museum at all. The Broads have sort of bounced around from funding, you know, a half dozen different museums in Los Angeles. And, you know, as one critic asked to me, is what they're doing even, you know, patronage? Is it even, what is it, you know? I think there's some issue about, you know, what is the Broad, what is it actually giving you? And the collection's not nearly as, I think, good as the building at the moment.
Admission is free, isn't it?
That's one of the nice things about it, though.
Yeah.
Whatever. So you're seeing this very valuable art, but you don't have to pay.
And at least you're not giving them $20 for it.
No, and that's really nice. And another thing I really, really, really liked about it is that, unlike most museums where you enter through the gift shop and the restaurant and then a giant event space, here the restaurant's not in the building. This is really a museum about art. It's, you know, there's 100% art and 0% anything else, or very little. The shop is kind of sequestered around. The main entry hall isn't really an ideal event space. That's a sort of a lawn that can be used for events. So it's an art museum that's about art, which it seems like unusual these days, as strange as that may seem.
He is currently, Eli Broad has expressed interest in the past, I know, in purchasing the Los Angeles Times, right?
Yes, he has. He had a failed bid recently to purchase the LA Times that led to the ouster of the publisher.
Good times in the newspaper. industry.
You were at the announcement recently for the Nasher Prize. What did you think about that?
Well, I was, I think Lauren and I were at Mike Granberry actually wrote our story on it. But I was, I think it's a really interesting idea that I was somewhat dubious of the Nasher Prize. I mean, the idea is to give $100,000, right, to some sculptor. So I think the inspiration was the Pritzker Prize, right, mm-hmm. Which is the prize given annually to an architect. And within architecture, there's some suspicion. I mean, most architects look on that with a little bit of skepticism. It's a huge award for the public. But what exactly is it awarding? Is it awarding a lifetime body of work? In the past, it's sort of created, or do you give it to a younger architects? How do you give it to people who work in partnership? Do these people actually need money or do they not need money? Is it creating a separate class of designer, like the Tom Main star versus the normal practitioner who works in collaboration and is perhaps more self-effacing? And the question in the profession is that kind of thing healthy? But I think overall it's seen as promotional to architecture as a whole. So the question is, what is this prize going to do for sculpture? And the idea is it's going to promote sculpture, get more people talking about sculpture. And I think the initial choice, you know, you could ask, like, who's it going to be? Are you just going to give it to somebody at the end of their career after a successful career in the art market, career as an artist? Net with the art market where it is, you know, they don't need $100,000. You know, I don't think, you know, Jeff Koons needs another $100,000 from the Nashers.
More puppy dogs,
right? Or Richard Serra, you know, much as I love his work. So I thought it was refreshing to see it go to Dora Salcedo, a really interesting sculptor from Colombia. And if this is what it's going to be, then that's great.
But I still feel like this doesn't tell us what it's going to be. I got the impression, well, I get the impression that they sat around one day and thought, we need to do something so people will take the Nasher seriously on an international scale. And their first choice was money. The first thing they went to was to create a prize and show off, like, we can get $100,000 and give it to someone. And then they got a pretty good panel of jurors. And they picked someone that I think it's not a fully obvious choice, but when they're, you know, when they're sitting around thinking who's challenging what sculpture is today, she is one of the first people that comes to mind. She's also a strong choice in that she's a non-white female, which they've taken heat for not having right. enough female art in their collection. So I still will be interested to see, okay, this is a great choice, but what happens next year?
And why do they have the jury in London?
Right.
You know, it's like if...
They met at the Tate.
It all seemed kind of strange to me. And I think it's reasonable ask. You know, look, they're going to do it for 10 years. That's $1 million. Would it be better to put $1 million? Is there a better way to spend $1 million? And I don't have $1 million, so I'm not going to get that chance. But... you know, I understand the motivations behind it. I get, you know, the proof will be in the pudding for it. If they can find, you know, 9 more Dora Salcedos, then maybe that works out to be great. But if they can't, then, you know, we'll see what happens.
Before we go, Mark, just in brief, what do you think Dallas could learn from the Broad?
They went and found really good architects, gave them some freedom, and they put them on a site in downtown, and they worked to create something that was going to be pedestrian-friendly and looking to the future towards a Los Angeles that wasn't just about the automobile. So I think that's really important.
And when does your story run? When does your Broad story publish?
A week from this Sunday.
Awesomeness. You can keep up with all things Lampster, and who wouldn't want to do that? Via Twitter at Mark Lampster. Dude, thanks for joining us.
Always my pleasure. Well, you are wasting time with the right guy.
Sports fans will be pouring into Dallas this weekend for the annual Texas OU game. While it's an exciting time, it also marks a dark anniversary. On this weekend in 1984, SMU sorority student Angie Simoda was brutally raped and stabbed to death. For more than 20 years, the lead suspect in her unsolved murder was prominent Dallas architect Russell Buchanan. He was eventually exonerated in a strange real-life plot twist. Our own Christopher Wynn wrote about the story for FD in 2012. Now it has been dramatized for a new investigative show called Suspicion on ID, the investigative discovery channel that aired last week. All of this had us wondering why the story continues to intrigue the public and why murder entertainment in general is so popular. Dallas Morning News crime writer Tristan Hallman is here to help us answer that larger question. But first, Christopher, let's start with Russell's story. For those who aren't familiar with it, what exactly happened here?
Russell, who some of you may know, is a very prominent Dallas architect. He's kind of most famous locally for a white box house he designed on Mockingbird Lane that is made out of what looks like refrigerator panels, sitting right next to a couple of sort of European castles. But before all that, he was a 23-year-old who had just started his first architecture job in East Dallas. He went to a happy hour at what is now Breadwinners on McKinney Avenue, and he met a young woman, a junior at SMU, named Angie Simoda. She was beautiful by all accounts. Her friend said that people would sometimes leave her love notes on her car. She was that striking. And she was smart. She was a Hockaday grad. She was studying computer engineering, electrical engineering, and computer science. And this was 1984. They hit it off. They became friends. She invited Russell and another girlfriend to go out on Friday night on Texas OU weekend. They went and did some bar hopping. They wrapped up around 1 a.m. Angie and her friend dropped off Russell. Angie dropped off her friend. She went home. Russell got up the next day, went to a wedding. Then he flew to Houston to go visit with his family. Came back late on Monday, went to his job, came home, and there was a knock on the door, and it was the Dallas Police Department. And there were several cops and cops with guns drawn, and they wanted to talk with him about the murder of Angie Simoda. And that was the first time he'd heard about it. What he found out was that after Angie had dropped him off, she went back to her apartment, and she had been raped and then stabbed to death 18 times in her apartment, and that's how she was found. And it's horrific, and I remember in looking at police reports, one of the officers that found her was a young woman who was around 20, who was around the same age as Angie, and is still sort of haunted by the memory of her eyes that were open when they found her. And I thought it was poignant that there was a moment about Angie's giant stuffed rabbit that was still in her room. So it was just a horrible case of innocence lost. They brought Russell down for questioning and grilled him.
For 20 years, it sounds like.
Yeah, for a long time. What initially happened is the police narrowed it down to about three suspects pretty quickly. Russell Buchanan, obviously. Angie had a boyfriend, a guy named Ben. And an ex-boyfriend who had been a little crazy in the past, had cut up her clothes in a fight, so he seemed like an obvious suspect. But because of the physical evidence that they collected at the scene, blood and there was a rape kit that they did, they were able to rule out her boyfriend and sort of the crazy ex-boyfriend, but they could not rule out Russell Buchanan. He was a match. It was not a DNA match, but his blood type was consistent with the intruder's blood and material found at the scene. So they zoomed in on him rather quickly.
How was his innocence eventually proven?
It's a strange twist in the story. Angie's best friend, Angie the victim, her best friend and college roommate, the police approached her. They told her their theory about Russell, and she cooperated with them to try to get Russell to admit something incriminating, which he never did. He did take a lie detector test. It was inconclusive. He passed it. Then the police later decided maybe he didn't. But her friend, the victim's friend, Sheila Wysocki is her name, she could not let it go. And as she went on with her life and watched Russell become a very successful and prominent architect, a man who got married, who built a big and impressive life in Dallas, she could not let go of the fact that he had gotten away in her mind with murdering her best friend. She kept hounding the police. She even went so far as to get her own private investigator's license, and she was able to get the police to reopen the case to look at the evidence. And by this time, this is post O.J. Simpson, DNA testing had come a long way, and they were able to submit evidence in the case, and they got back a DNA hit. She got a call one day from somebody with the Dallas police who said, "Sheila, we got him." And she expected to hear the next name be Russell Buchanan, and it wasn't. Instead, it was somebody she had never heard of, a man named Donald Andrew Bess, who was a 300-pound serial rapist who was already serving time but had been out in parole the night of Andy's death.
That's just a horrible story all the way around.
It was. I mean, just
thanks for bringing us down, Christopher.
But the good news, and what was so interesting, what intrigued me so much about the story was, you would expect at this point, Russell has a right to be extremely pissed off, to be extremely angry at the Dallas Police Department, at Sheila, who had helped torment him all those years, and he wasn't. He said, the Dallas Police Department was doing their job. If it had been your daughter or family member, you would hope that they would do the same thing. And likewise with Sheila, he said, you were just trying to help your friend. And it was really amazing. And they have become friends and remain so.
I think it's I will say that Russell and Karen, his wife, are some of our closest friends in Dallas. And just to know him, he's one of the most easygoing, kind, generous people you will meet, and that's just a testament to the way, also brilliant and wonderful architect, mm-hmm. but that's just the way he is. Not mad at the police or his situation, he is certainly feels very, very, very strongly about the Innocence Project and an opposition to capital punishment, because he is, a very, very good case of, someone innocent could very easily have been convicted.
You got to give credit to the police department, too, for not arresting him and putting him in jail like they do with a lot of other people with pretty weak cases.
Yeah, it's true.
Well, he's white.
Yeah, well, yeah.
So,
and
that
he wasn't,
helps.
Yeah. He was a college graduate who was going to become an architect.
Tristan, why do you think we are so fascinated with such stories? I mean, I guess it seems obvious, thou shalt not kill is one of the big commandments of the big ones. But give us some idea as to why these kinds of stories fascinate us so.
Well, there's always the sort of, like you mentioned, the salacious angle of it. There's a lot of intrigue that goes with the baser instinct, the primal, killing someone is one of the most primal things that you could do, is killing another person. But, we hear all the time, working here, that people don't want to read about the gory details of this or this. They want to read pleasant stories. But our analytics show that's not true. People love the crime stories. And as far as I know, they always have. But I think it's just, there's so much detail that goes to it. A lot of these murders that we hear about, we don't get a lot of information too early on. And sort of over the years or once the case comes out, you kind of see all the details and you piece it together. And people in their mind, they start piecing the puzzle together. How could this have happened? And that's the thing that people always ask when someone is killed, is like, what caused this? Everyone wants to know why. Not the fact that, someone was killed, or how they were killed, but why?
I wonder, too, and this is true for both sides of the story in this case, if it's a lot of like, this could happen to me, like you as the petite white female, that could happen to me at any point.
It could happen to you. And then Chris's story, that was like my worst nightmare, was imagining, you go home, you have your friends, and then suddenly you know you didn't do it.
Right.
And in your story, you're talking about how they would show up to his work and, right. People were talking about him. People knew that he was under investigation for murder. So you go around living under the fear that something is going to connect you to something that you had absolutely no knowledge of.
Well, it's the mistaken identity thing, right? This is what drives, half of Hitchcock's
work.
Right.
Say.
Yeah. Right. Totally, this is it.
Little Hitchcock, little Kafka.
Yeah.
Blended together.
Speaking of which, how was the TV thing they did about it?
Well, it's interesting. This story has had such a life that has played out in TV. Dateline NBC did a big splashy story on her murder, and that's actually how I first learned about it. I've known Russell for a long time, and I've written a lot about his work and his design work. And I saw a snippet of Dateline NBC, and I said, "What? Russell Buchanan?" And called him up, and we talked for the first time. He had never shared that story with me, which, if you know, with Russell, that's not surprising in a way, but. The story went on. It was developed by A&E. They did a show around it. Sheila Wysocki has been on Anderson Cooper Live and told the story. It's been picked up in smaller magazines and publications here and there. And then most recently, just last week, the ID Network Investigation Discovery did the story for a show they have called Suspicion. And this was, unfortunately, it's very dramatized. You know, going back to what Tristan said about the sensational aspect of it, you know, they did a lot of reenactments, and it was strange to, you know, see, here's the moody guy playing Russell Buchanan, and here's the, you know, the whippersnapper friend turned detective, you know, and it's
totally schlock.
Yeah, it's kind of like, yes, it's like if Lifetime Network.
Yeah,
but it's Investigation Discovery Channel. I mean, certainly their imprimatur of quality would be all over.
Chris, your story was so fantastic. I mean, it wasn't that way. And
right.
It is such a, you know, it could be anybody. And as you, Tristan, this is the ultimate narrative, right? It's murder, mistaken identity. It's
kind of all those things.
I remember the first time I heard the story, I was with you,
yes,
Chris.
I was going to go there, but why don't you go there?
No, I defer to you.
We were having dinner with Russell and his wife and some of our mutual friends, and he just ended up kind of like mentioning, yeah, there's that one time where they thought I murdered, and we're like, huh? And Lamster and I were just sitting there, gape-mouthed, listening.
He actually said it was one time.
Yeah, no, well, I don't.
It was funny because we were.
It's not verbatim.
Yeah.
No, because it was one of those, you know, wonderful Dallas nights where everybody's sitting out on a porch
having a glass of wine,
and it's a pretty night, and everybody's telling a story, and everybody went around the circle with an interesting story, and some were funny and some were kind of sad. And then it got to Russ, and he's like, well, I've got a story. And that was the story to end the night.
Oh, wow.
So no one tried to top him after that.
You cannot beat that one.
Yeah. No way.
So, Tristan, I'm curious, was this something, have you always wanted to be a crime reporter?
No, actually. I really didn't have much interest in that, you know, growing up. I didn't know I was going to be a reporter until college. And even then, I was a political science major focused on politics. So it was something I just kind of fell into. And I was never really that interested in the true crime kind of stuff, maybe sort of tangentially. But I really enjoyed it. I mean, it's horrible. It's tragic, but it is sort of it's real life.
You must have to do a lot of compartmentalizing because I couldn't do what you do. I could not be a crime reporter. There's several things that I can do in the newspaper business, including be a critic. Crime reporting is not one of them.
You really do have to kind of compartmentalize. I remember there was one time where I actually had to tell, you know, because I got her on the phone and I had waited a while. I got a woman on the phone and basically told her that her son had been killed by the police because nobody had told her yet. And, you know, that was probably the worst day that I remember. But other than that, I mean, I kind of look at it this way. It's going to happen regardless of whether I'm involved or not. You know, I am there to do a service. I'm not seeing myself in any sort of, you know, muckraking way when I'm reporting on crime itself. It's just, you know, what happened and try to shed some light on that.
So you have a crime podcast, the Dallas Morning News.
Yeah, we actually started that a couple weeks ago. We're calling it Texas Crime Cast. We have it come out every Thursday afternoon. And it's been a lot of fun so far. We're not as good at talkers as you guys yet, but we're working on it.
Never run out of crime.
Yeah, you have a bottomless resource of material.
It's crime and it's, you know, criminal justice and sort of some of the broader issues. Obviously, we're not talking a whole lot about you know, drug house murders, but definitely like the one in Uptown that we just had, or, you know, a story like Chris's would be very appropriate for that.
It's a cool show. I've listened to it. It's good. You guys are doing a great job.
Well, thank you very much.
You can read Christopher Wynn's story about Russell Buchanan at fdmag.com. We'll also include a link on our show page at guidelive.com/podcasts. You can find out more about Suspicion at investigationdiscovery.com. And also, please check out that Dallas Morning News crime podcast. It's Texas Crime Cast at dallasnews.com. We'll be right back. It's time to move on to our touts. This is the portion of our show where each of us recommends one thing we are reading, watching, clicking on, listening to, or just plain obsessed with. I will get us started. It's actually something that I am drinking in a place where I'm hanging out. No, I'm not back on that. So there's this new, I don't even know if it's that new anymore. Mark Lamster actually told me about it. It's a coffee shop downtown right by the West End Dart Rail stop called Urban Blend. It is part of a church. And Lamster did this big thing about finding the New Yorker coming to Dallas and trying to find good coffee. And he told me about this place. So I went and visited. And man, first of all, the coffee is fantastic. Really, really rich, potent, creamy latte.
Oh, sounds good right now.
Really nice, natural lighting, free Wi-Fi. It's sort of my new downtown. If you want to stalk me, anybody, it's sort of my new downtown writing.
On a show about serial killers, are you sure you want to?
No.
But you didn't bring some for everybody.
No, I'm sorry. I did not. But I've been, I'm a big, you know, coffee shop. I write and read in coffee shops a lot.
Yeah.
And so when I find sort of the golden combination of great coffee, really good light, and free Wi-Fi, then
kind of everything the Morning News is not, our old building downtown.
I did not say that.
I'm just saying, fired. No windows, average coffee, spotty Wi-Fi. We love it anyway, but
I wouldn't say it's average.
That's Christopher
coffee.
Wynn, ladies and gentlemen. See Wynn at dallasnews.com. So yes, Urban Blend, check it out. The street address is on Elm, but I believe it's actually on this little street called Austin Street, and it is right by the West End Dart Stop. Lauren?
Awesome. I'm going to tout the new exhibit at the Dallas Museum of Art. It is called International Pop. And it's one of those things where I think a lot of people think they know what pop art is, and they think Liechtenstein or they think Warhol. But this is sort of looking at all the different movements that happened during that period around the world. And I saw it first at the Walker, which is where it originated in Minneapolis. And now it's in Dallas. And there's so much art in this exhibit. It's huge. There's just so much to see. So I think it runs through January 17th. Opens today.
CW.
I have a twofer. That Tommy, he's good. I've got a twofer tout. One, the new American Horror Story debuts tonight, American Horror Story Hotel.
Who's the star?
Lady Gaga.
No way.
Is really? Kind of the big name in it. Yes, Lady Gaga is going to be in it. That's kind of why I'm sort of curious to check in.
She's kind of a big deal.
Yeah.
So I've they heard. Tell me.
Yeah. I love the original American Horror Story. I hated the other ones. I thought they were really just got wheels off bad.
Was the original one Jessica Lange?
Yes.
Okay. That was
really
good.
It's kind of the haunted house one, so to speak, their first one. I thought it was really interesting and different. It was a good blending of genres, and I thought it was really fresh and unexpected. And then it got less fresh as they kept repeating it multiple seasons later. But I'm excited about this one, too, because it is reportedly inspired on an incident at the Cecil Hotel in downtown L.A. that you all might remember a couple of years ago with a young Canadian student who checked in, and then they found her body in the water tank on the roof of the hotel.
This is like the darkest mixed media podcast
ever, kind of
by
is.
The way.
It was very weird. It was very weird. There was weird security footage of her in the elevator seemingly being stalked by something. I don't know. It's very strange. So I'm curious to see what Ryan Murphy does with all of that in a TV show. On the flip side, I'm...
Something happy. Something smiley.
Actually, kind of not, no. Unfortunately.
More children's choirs?
No, not this episode. There's a new podcast I like from Esquire magazine. It's called Esquire Classic, and they've just done the first one. They're taking some of their classic stories, and they read portions of it, and they talk with the writer, and they discuss it, and they kind of talk about the story in modern context. And they have the great and crazy writer Tom Juno on this first one, talking about a story he did in 2003 called Falling Man, kind of about a famous AP photograph of a man falling from the Twin Tower during the September 11th attack. So, again, kind of dark material, but super fascinating and interesting. And that story was apparently their most read story ever. And it's interesting to talk about it in today's context. So check it out, Esquire Classic.
Lampsta.
Well, I also have a dark tout, but it's a comically dark tout, a hilariously dark tout. It is a book, and I will admit the book is authored by a friend and former boss, Kevin Lippert. And the book is called War Plan Red. And this is a book that publishes the war plans devised in the 1920s and 1930s by the United States and Canada, respectively, for invading each other. So the United States had plans to invade Canada, and Canada, believe it or not, had plans to invade the United States, just in case, just in case. So with Ted Cruz, I don't know, running for president, and, you know, Canada invading the United States is, I guess, remains a threat. But no, in all seriousness, it's a, he tracked down the actual war plans from the Library of Congress, where you can find each of these actual war plans. And he's reprinted them. They're actual things. And then there's commentary that goes with them. And they're actually kind of hilarious documents in their own ridiculousness. Of course, there were serious reasons why, you know, if Russia invades Canada, we need to invade Canada. So, but I mean, to me, it's like a hilarious historical timepiece and a fun little talking object that you can put on your coffee table.
I love Canada personally.
I'm a big fan.
I would never
absolutely
eat the Canadians first. Invade.
Yeah,
good syrup. Donald Fowler, what would you like to tout?
I would like to tout Emporium Pies in Oak Cliff. Yum. I am crazy. I had the best cherry pie ever there.
And they're like super deep dish, like five layers deep, flaky.
It is, if my mom would actually make a pie that wasn't horrible.
Damn. Sorry, Mom.
I don't mean that negative. I mean, this is like homemade pies. I mean, they're crazy, and they're the sweetest people in the world, and I love it. It's in some little old house, and you can sit outside. You feel like you're in, like, some old book.
And people, like, line up to get them sometimes. You have to be strategic on when you go.
That is very true. I haven't run into the line yet.
Are you going to write a musical about someone who chops people up and puts them into pies?
I think that's been done.
Oh, wait.
Oh, yeah.
The sequel.
Yeah.
Can you buy by the slice there?
That's what you do, yeah. Awesome. Oh, I'm sure you can buy a whole pie, I guess.
You could, but why would you stop at one slice?
You could buy a bunch of whole pies and then have a contest and eat them. Yeah. That's been done, too.
That's called a pie contest.
Yes. Exactly.
And by the way, they have those pies at Wild Detective, just so we can get another plug-in for Wild
Detectives.
They do.
Oh, I like that place. I went there with you. Yeah.
Yeah, you did.
Yeah, cool.
Tristan, what do you got?
Well, I guess keeping on the funny, dark, and crime-related spree here, Fargo Season 2 starts Monday on FX. I was a really big fan of both the movie and the first season of the show, which if you haven't watched it, there's a fun tie-in to the actual movie. It's kind of, in a way, a sequel. This is a prequel to that. I loved the show, and it's an entirely new cast of characters with one of the characters from the original show, so I'm thrilled that it's back.
I need to watch the first season still. I did just watch the movie again on a long flight.
It's
reminded,
like,
again how great it is.
It's like Coen Brothers and meets Quentin Tarantino in a way, with some of the violence in it. It's definitely, you know, it's very similar to the movie, but there are enough differences to where you're not just constantly comparing it to the movie.
Cool.
And starring Dallas's own Alison Tolman.
That was the first season. She won't be on this season. I guess her character.
Oh, darn.
Her character is like 6 years old, so it was kind of a stretch.
Yeah, that probably makes sense.
You'll find links to some of the things we've talked about today on our show page at guidelive.com/podcasts. Drop us an email at mixedmedia@dallasnews.com or send us a tweet at @mixedmediapod. Please subscribe to our show in iTunes and leave us a review, but make sure it's a good one. Just search for our name. Today's Mixed Media was engineered by Brian Elledge and produced by Christopher Wynn.
Actually, we had a different engineer today, Mr.
That's
Tommy.
Right. Sorry. They're all, you guys are all the same to me.
Hey now.
Today's show was engineered by the great Tommy Noel. Ladies and gentlemen, round of applause to make up for my horrible misstep there. Produced by Christopher Wynn. We'll be back next Thursday with a new episode. Until then, for Christopher Wynn, Lauren Smart, Mark Lamster, Tristan Hallman, and Donald Fowler. It's a very stocked guest list this week.
It is.
I'm Chris Wagner, and we thank you for joining us.